to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome. My name is David Wilkins. I'm the director of the program on the legal profession here at Harvard Law School, and I teach many courses in the area, and I have been a student of the legal profession for a very long time, including around issues of diversity and inclusion. And as such a student, I have rarely seen somebody make as important an impact as Brad Smith has in these areas, in all of these areas, really. Microsoft, as you know, is an innovator in its core business of technology. But I think what's so interesting is that Brad has also made it an incredibly innovative company, let's say in his part of the core business, which is the business of lawyering, both in terms of its model of internal legal department. He runs a legal department that has, a modest 1,000 people altogether, not all of whom are lawyers. And perhaps during the Q&A, it'll be interesting for people to hear a little bit about that. They've been incredibly innovative in their relationship with outside law firms generally. He's been a vital part in forging collaborations with academics on a range of issues, including our very own Berkman Center, and we're lucky enough to hear to have Terry Fisher, the faculty and director of the center, or one of the faculty directors of the center, and really one of the most innovative people around the world thinking about these issues. Brad was very kind to come and share, a paper that you've written about this incredibly exciting new set of developments around cloud computing, and to engage with our academics at the Berkman Center about how to think about this innovation and what its implications are. So he's right at the intersection between sort of the legal world and the world of legal academics and the world that legal academics think about and what their core business is. But he has also devoted an important part of his time and put an important part of his personal credibility around a set of issues that many people talk about and bemoan, but few people take concrete action on. And that is the fact that more than 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education, when we look at the legal profession today, we still see far less diversity than I think any of us who were around when the changes began to happen would have hoped we would have seen. It's easy to make that observation. It's easy to bemoan it as a state of affairs that we wish would change. What's difficult is to try to develop some concrete ideas and solutions around really making progress on that issue. And Brad has been a leader in that, not just in his own company, but in the general counsel community, as well as in the larger bar community as well. He's devoted time, attention, and again, put his money where his mouth is, which is in sometimes the most important thing for people to do around these issues. And he has now agreed to share with us some of what he's learned, some of what the successes are, perhaps some of what the frustrations are, and maybe some of what the challenges are for this community of students and faculty and others who care about these issues, what we can do. So without further ado, Brad Smith.
Well, thank you, and thanks to all of you for spending a little bit of time late in the afternoon, especially on such a beautiful day. I really wanted to talk about three things this afternoon. I wanted to start by giving you just a little bit of perspective about how we at Microsoft came to become so fixated and focused on the diversity issue and why we have this passion about it. Second, talk a little bit about the state of diversity in the legal profession. You know, how are we doing as a profession? And third, and really most importantly, talk about what, in concrete terms, we think it's going to take for the legal profession to become a substantially more diverse profession than we are right now. But let me start with sort of our path to focusing on this topic. Microsoft is one of the biggest users of legal services and the courts on a global basis, just because our products are everywhere. And one of the interesting features about software is that it's not only used everywhere, but it's very easily stolen everywhere. It's one of the most widely pirated and counterfeited products in the world. And as a result, we have the opportunity to enforce our intellectual property rights through the courts on a global basis in a way that very few institutions on the planet really do. Each year, we typically bring over 4,000 actions to enforce our copyrights. And we do that in over 70 countries. And you get a remarkable window on the world, if you will, through which to see the role and work of lawyers and the role and work of the judicial and legal systems. And there's a lot of things that you see that are really quite harrowing. There's a lot of parts of the world where it is dangerous to be a lawyer. For example, in one of our recent cases, we had our lawyers turn up for settlement negotiations in one of our cases. And instead of settling the case, they were literally beaten up by the people who turned up for the other side, not something that law students are trained to handle. There are many parts of the world where it is hazardous to be a witness. We've had two cases in a country in Asia where literally immediately after testifying on our behalf, the witnesses walked out of the courtroom and were physically hurled down the staircase in the courthouse. You know, there are many parts of the world where it is precarious to be a party in a lawsuit. Certainly, I can think of a country in Eastern Europe where we sue people engaged in counterfeiting. And we know that the maximum amount that we can settle a case for in that country is $1,000. Because if we're not prepared to take $1,000 to settle the case, the judge is prepared to take $1,000 to dispose of it. And so what one really gains from all of that is a keen appreciation of everything that we all too often take for granted in this country. You know, warts and all, we have a judicial system and a legal process that is fundamental to the country's well-being. Not only is it fundamental to the country's well-being, but law plays a role in American society that in some respects goes well beyond the role of law in other societies, for the simple reason that when you look at the American population, it is the law that binds us together. It's not some overarching religion. We have no state religion. We have no religion that the preponderance of the population shares. We don't have an ancient philosophy that we can look back to for hundreds or thousands of years. We don't have cultural traditions that go nearly as far back either. What we do have is a system of laws that I think most Americans, from the day they're educated, whether they are born here or come here from somewhere else, come to appreciate is fundamental to how our society works. But it's also fundamental to that role of law in this country that we have a legal profession that is as diverse as the country itself. And that, to me, is the way I believe we should define our goal as a profession. We should aspire to have a legal profession that is as diverse as the country itself. Because people who are going to turn to the law and rely on the law and work with lawyers need the opportunity to connect with people who understand them, who are like them, and who can relate to them. And for some people, for many people, they may not feel it needs to be someone just like them, but for many others, it makes a profound difference, both in terms of the ability of citizens as clients to turn to lawyers and the ability of lawyers to effectively represent their clients. And as a result of this, you know, in the decades since Brown versus Board of Education, and really over the last 15 or 20 years, I think there has been a growing awareness in the country of the importance of diversity for the legal profession. There have been a lot of good intentions in a lot of important legal institutions, law firms, companies, and others. And certainly as I speak with people, I'm constantly reminded of the strong and positive intentions that so many people have. But it takes a lot more than good intentions to do just about anything. And I'm particularly reminded by some words that were uttered a couple of years ago by Mark Hurd. Mark Hurd is the CEO of Hewlett-Packard, HP. Fortune magazine, 2 years ago, was doing a feature. It interviewed a number of people and it asked them, what's the best advice you ever got? And I was very struck by what Mark Hurd had to say. In just a couple of paragraphs, he said the following. 9 years after starting at NCR, which was the first company he worked at, he said, I moved to a head office job in Dayton in 1988. An NCR executive was giving a presentation. He had great slides and an even better delivery. The CEO, Chuck Exley, listened to the entire presentation in his typically gracious, courteous manner. At the conclusion, he nodded and said something brief but profound. Good story, but it's hard to look smart with bad numbers. And as I reflected on it, the presenter, articulate as he was, as good as his slides were, simply had bad numbers. That comment has always stayed with me. You have to focus on the underlying substance. There's just no way to disguise poor performance. I've tried to follow that advice throughout my career. Deliver good numbers, and you earn the right for people to listen to you. Well, that really brings me to the second thing I'd like to address. What is the state of our performance as a legal profession? Or put more precisely, what do our numbers look like? Unfortunately, as a profession, we're a lot like that presenter that Chuck Exley was listening to. We don't have great numbers. And this is reflected in some of the numbers that have emerged most recently. You know, in January, there was a clinic at Columbia Law School that looked at enrollment data over the 15-year period from 1993 to 2008. And during this 15-year period, enrollment in the nation's law schools rose a bit. It rose from 43,500 to 46,500. But at a time of rising enrollment overall, the enrollment of African Americans and Mexican Americans in the nation's law schools actually fell a bit, from 4,142 in 1993 to 4,060 15 years later. And it wasn't because their GPAs were falling, because they were rising. It wasn't because their LSAT scores were falling, they were rising. But for whatever reason, we have not been succeeding in moving more people of that background into our nation's law schools. A second slice, if you will, is to look at the state of diversity in the country's large law firms. And in particular, to look at the demographics for partners in the nation's large law firms. Now, the National Association of Law Placement has been gathering this over a period of time, and what it shows is that last year, only 19% of the nation's large law firm partners were women, up from 16% in the year 2000. So over the course of 9 years, despite all of the focus on diversity, women only moved from 16% to 19% in the partnership ranks. The situation for minorities is about the same. Last year, 6% were minorities, you know, far less than the representation in the American population, up from 3% in the year 2000. So if you look not just at law school, but at law firm partnerships, the situation really is not terribly encouraging. And then you can look at the state of affairs in the here and now and ask, what has this terrible recession meant for the state of diversity in the nation's law firms? Well, of course, the contraction in law firms has happened mostly at the non-partner level, associates of counsel and others. And what one recent study showed was that over the last decade, in a large collection of law firms, the number of non-partner attorneys had contracted by 10%. But during this period of time, the number of Asian Americans had fallen by 11%. The number of Hispanics had fallen by 13%. And the number of African Americans had fallen by 16%. So in other words, diversity fared poorly as people from diverse backgrounds lost their jobs to a higher degree than the number of non-partner attorneys as a whole. So in all of these respects, it's hard to feel that we're just about to turn the corner. To the contrary, we seem to be working very hard. There are a lot of people with good intentions doing some very good things, but we don't really seem to be moving the needle or making a huge amount of progress. And I think it's important in this kind of context to step back and not only ask why, but ask how can we do better. Now, I actually think that there's a lot that the legal profession can learn from the world of business when it comes to how to do better. Certainly, we've found that in Microsoft, and we've actually found it's a real advantage to be working on this issue as lawyers inside a company surrounded by business people where we're constantly immersed in the way business works and the way businesses pursue specific objectives. And what we've concluded is that there is a five-part recipe, if you will, if we're going to do better. And it's not to say that there's not other parts and other things that will be learned, but certainly where we sit today, there are at least five things that we need to do as a profession. The first is this. We need clear, measurable goals as institutions and as a profession. It's great to talk about improving diversity in general, but unless one is able to sit down and establish clear, measurable goals for oneself and one's own institution, it's actually pretty difficult to know whether you're going forwards or backwards, and it's very difficult to know what's working and what's not. Certainly at Microsoft, we've found that it makes sense for us to create clear, measurable goals. So, for example, we have four goals for our own diversity work. One is to increase the percentage of women in the United States at the more senior levels of our department. Today, 36% of our attorneys in the United States are women. 35% of our most senior ranks are filled by women. And our goal has been to grow some of these numbers by about 1 point a year, a goal that we've achieved this year and in most of the last few. A second goal that we have is to grow the ranks of minorities among our attorney population. Today, 23% of our attorneys in the United States are minorities. 19% of our most senior attorneys are minorities. And our goal has been to grow that by about half a point a year. We've fulfilled that goal this year, and we've been fulfilling it most of the last few years. A third goal we have is to move the needle at the law firms that we work most closely with, specifically on the diverse representation of Microsoft Matters, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And the fourth goal that we have is to increase the amount of spending that we do at so-called WIMBY firms, women and minority business enterprises, in this case law firms, that in effect are owned by women and minorities. And that obviously is different from giving work to women and minorities who work at large law firms, where a majority of the partners are men. You know, we look at these firms in particular. And our goal was to get 4.35% of our spending this fiscal year to those firms, and we're on track to get over 5%. But we do sit down and we create goals, and we create them on a three-year basis, and then we create annual benchmarks and goals in between now and then to see how we're doing. And I have to say, as I go and I visit with law firms, those that do work with us, those that do work with others, or I sit down with other companies, I often ask, do you have measurable goals for your diversity work? And almost always, the answer is no. People say, we have a great diversity program, we're very committed to diversity work, we're spending lots of time on it, but when push comes to shove, they don't define those goals in measurable terms or in the terms of the demographics of their institution. And you have to ask, well, why is that? Is it because people actually don't care? And I don't think that's it. I actually think that the answer, as I found, actually is centered in the role of employment lawyers. Employment lawyers are often counseling clients that it would be risky to create goals that are put in these kinds of measurable terms. They advise that it could cause some people to perceive that it's not just a goal, but it's a quota. or that you might have more problems if you set a goal and you fail to meet it. Or that people will think that even if you're doing the right things and meeting your goals, you're doing it for the wrong reasons, and you'll give rise to claims of reverse discrimination. Certainly, we had that kind of conversation in all of its elements with the employment lawyers who work inside Microsoft. But we found it possible to navigate our way through them. And I analogize in this kind of situation to the way businesses think about setting goals for generating revenue and generating profit. Now, there are, as we all sort of know, about 1,000 ways to make money the wrong way. And the large majority of those wrong ways to make money are, in fact, illegal. But I'm not aware of a single company that fails to set a measurable goal for growing its revenue and improving its profitability. How do they do it? They set goals and then they put a lot of policies and controls in place to ensure that they don't grow their revenue the wrong way. Yes, you could grow your revenue by engaging in fraud, but there are controls to ensure that it doesn't happen. And there are many illustrations of that, and we have a Securities and Exchange Commission in part to ensure that these kinds of things take hold and stay firm. The question in our mind is, then why shouldn't we do the same thing when it comes to diversity? Isn't it a better approach to ask institutions to set clear, measurable goals and then put in place safeguards to avoid the pitfalls that people want to steer clear of? It's the logical path forward in our view. So that's sort of step one, clear, measurable goals. The second thing we think that's needed in practice is transparency. It's only if one's results are transparent that people are really going to know whether they're making progress or not. And here I actually think there has been substantial progress over the last decade in the law firm side of the legal profession. General counsels across the country over the last decade have actually done, I think, quite a good job of pushing law firms to be more transparent. And hence, you can typically find good data that show the demographic composition of most law firms. I do think this is an area where general counsels need to do a better job of applying to themselves the standards that they are applying to the law firms that work for them. Because you don't have the same ability to get data on the diverse composition of lawyers in corporate legal departments. And I think part of the maturation of our profession and the in-house part of the profession in particular should frankly involve corporate legal departments on an in-house basis stepping up and signing up for these kinds of transparent reporting as well. So transparency is the second thing that I think is needed for success. The third thing that I think is needed for success is a more strategic focus. Now, this at some level is all about business strategy in a way. Business strategy applied to law firms and legal departments. If you just set the goals, then you have to ask what are the right strategies to pursue them. And you know, at Microsoft, we've really focused on four strategic areas. Number one has been strengthening the pipeline and doing what we can to contribute to it. Number two has been recruiting and lawyer development. Number three has been focusing with our law firms as partners in specific areas to grow their diversity. And number four has been advocacy in the profession. But what we do is we decide what our strategic areas of focus are going to be. We have people sit down and then define very concrete strategies. We use that to guide our investments. If something is on strategy, we put more resources behind it. If it's off strategy, we put less or even nothing behind it. And we then evaluate whether our strategies are leading to the outcomes in terms of the clear and measurable goals we're seeking to create. Now, this is where I'll contrast that approach with the approach that I've seen in many businesses, including our own at various points of time, and what I sometimes encounter with law firms. People are doing lots of work. They have lots of energy, lots of passion, and there are lots of activities. But lots of activities without a strategic focus that is connected to clear and measurable goals is, as we've often found inside our company and many others, not all that likely to lead to the specific results that you're trying to create. And I think getting better alignment around strategies and clear and measurable goals is of fundamental importance if we're going to move the needle as a profession. Now, the fourth area on which we focused, you could argue is the most important. It's probably the one where you could argue we've done the most to innovate in the profession. And the fourth thing that I think is needed is accountability. And so the question you have to ask is, how in our society, in a free market economy, do people by and large hold themselves and others in their institution accountable for doing certain things? The answer, I believe, is you pay for performance. If people do good work, you pay them more. If people don't do good work, you pay them less. If they do good work, you give them more work. You give them the next job. If they don't do good work, you don't give them the next job, or perhaps you even just let them go. And in the legal profession, there's been a lot of talk about diversity, but I don't think there's been a lot of accountability around diversity. You know, we really sat down 2 years ago and we asked, well, what was the right way to go about changing it? And probably the most important thing we decided was to create a new program for the large law firms with whom we do the most work, our law firm diversity program. And with these firms, we said that the last 2% of their fees would have to be earned as a bonus for doing good diversity work. And we didn't just say, you know, go out and do good work and have a lot of activities. We said we want to see defined and measurable progress. And we said we wanted to see it in one of two ways. Either we wanted to see the percentage of diverse lawyers working on Microsoft Matters grow by 2 points over the preceding year, or we wanted to see the attorney population of the firm as a whole grow more diverse by at least 0.5 point. So if a firm had 20% of its hours in the preceding year worked for Microsoft by diverse attorneys, we wanted to see it be at least 22%. And if the firm was 31% diverse a year ago, we hoped it would be at least 31.5% diverse a year later. And we said to firms that they could choose their method. This year, we've also given firms an additional way to earn the bonus. Rather than just say you've got to keep improving every year, we said, if you are as diverse as we are, you don't have to get any better until we get better, which we will. But you don't have to get any better until we get better. We said 52% of our lawyers in the United States are either women or minorities. So if 52% of your lawyers are either women or minorities, you can rest on your laurels. One firm actually has been in a position to do that, actually, but only one. But I will say we've seen a lot of progress in law firms. In the first year, we saw one firm improve its diversity on our matters by 12 points. So even though only two would have been sufficient to earn the bonus, you know, they really worked hard and the results were extremely encouraging. Now, we did recognize when we did this that if we were going to hold them accountable, we needed to hold ourselves accountable as well. And part of the reason we did this is we recognized, as firms explained to us, that even if they wanted to put more diverse attorneys on their matters, they actually needed the help of the lawyers inside Microsoft, because very often it's the lawyers in-house who decide who's going to do the work at a particular firm. So we took my bonus and the bonus of all of the individuals who report to me, so about 15 of us in the department, and we each get a merit bonus. Everybody at Microsoft who's not paid on an hourly basis gets a merit bonus once a year, and we said that each of us would get paid the last 5% of the bonus we earned only if 75% of the law firms actually successfully earned their bonus. Anything short of that, and we would give that up. Well, as it turned out, after the first year, only 67% of the law firms owned their only 67% of the law firms earned their bonus. So we didn't get that last 5%. And instead, we've taken all of that money and pooled it, and as a company, we're contributing it to pay for college scholarships for minority individuals in Seattle and Washington, D.C., who have an interest in either technology or the law, or ideally even both. And so we're hopefully putting that money to good work, at least in a small way, in the profession as a whole. But I do think that one needs fundamentally to think about how the pay for performance can reshape the work of lawyers in our profession. From our standpoint, you know, there are times when you should really make a hiring decision based in part on the diversity of the teams that come before you. And indeed, as teams have come before us to make the pitch that they should do particular work, and I've met with them, and so have our other senior folks, every single time we've looked around the room and we've asked them and we've talked about the diversity of the team. And there are times when, just as with individuals, you should let firms go if they're not embracing the goals that you want them to pursue. And I actually think there is a fair amount of frustration at this moment in the law firm side of our profession that companies haven't done a good enough job of really rewarding firms that do good work on diversity or penalizing those that don't. And I think that's important feedback for us in the general counsel community to consider and to act upon. But we also wanted to take the pay for performance concept and do more with it than just simply make it sort of a, you either win completely and get the work or you lose completely and you get fired, even though those are absolutely important. We wanted to create an everyday opportunity for people to know that the decisions they would be making about the diverse composition of their firms and their teams for us could yield a benefit and, you know, use the carrot, if you will, to encourage people to get more focused and take more steps. So that's the fourth area on which we focus, really this focus on accountability. The fifth and last area on which we've really focused is on the need for what we perceive to be for the profession as a whole to really come together and unite and take more effective action around the building of a stronger pipeline for the profession going forward. There is a lot of work that goes on across our profession to support work to create a better pipeline. But I think today we're very, very fragmented as a profession. Every law firm, every company has their favorite cause that they support. We're no exception to. But what we're lacking as a result is that cohesive understanding of how the pipeline is working today and where is it falling short. You know, if you do a pipeline analysis, typically what you do is you start by defining where you want to consider your pipeline to begin and where you want it to end, and then you identify the holes along the way. You know, so one way to do a pipeline analysis is to start with people who are graduating from high school and going to college, and then looking at people who are going from college to law school, and then people who are going from law school into the profession, and ask, where are the holes, where are we losing the people that we would really like to have join our profession? And we don't have a cohesive view across the profession today, although there's a lot of literature that can help inform that kind of analysis. Nor do we have a shared consensus around the right strategic approach for the profession. Nor do we have a concerted effort to encourage people, whether they're in law firms or companies or elsewhere, to support activities that are going to do the most good in advancing the strategies that are considered to be the most impactful. And that's another thing that we're really trying to address. I'm part of a group called the Legal Counsel for Legal Diversity, LCLD. It consists of general counsels at large companies and the managing partners of large law firms. I happen to chair the pipeline committee of that group. And one of our goals is to build the kind of consensus across the legal profession that would enable us to have a more common understanding of where the pipeline is falling short, a more common view of some of the strategies that would be most impactful, and a more energetic view to encouraging institutions to raise some more money and really contribute it as they see fit, but hopefully in a way that would reinforce the strategies and some of the groups that are pursuing the best practices in making the pipeline more robust for the future. If you put all five of these things together, I believe that what we really need as a profession is a long-term vision and a big goal. I mean, the truth is the last decade was not a decade with great success. it was a decade of small steps and incremental progress at best. I think that diversity is a cause worth embracing for our profession as a whole, and we would be well served to come together and really think about and define the kinds of measurable goals we believe we could achieve a decade from now in the year 2020. And the last thing that I'll leave you with here is, as we think about where we might be as a diverse profession a decade from now, the students who are in law schools today have an enormous amount to contribute, and frankly, in my opinion, need to help own our work to solve this problem and make the profession stronger. It's not a problem that anybody who's in law school today helped create, and they're certainly not responsible for the relatively small amount of progress. But it is absolutely a situation to which everyone has the opportunity to contribute over the next decade, not just because 10 years from now, people who are in law school today may be partners in law firms or in other important positions, but because even in the months and year, just the next year ahead, everyone, I believe, has an opportunity to have a bigger impact. I know that when I sit down with a law firm that wants to do work with us, I can have a positive impact simply by asking them about what their diversity strategy is. What are their measurable goals? What are they doing? What is their vision about where they're going to be 3 years from now? And I also know you don't have to be a general counsel to ask those questions. I know that anybody who's a law student who has an offer that hasn't yet been accepted is in a position to interview the law firms and decide where they're going to go work. And I know that the more people who ask these questions, the more impact there will be in encouraging the legal profession as a whole to focus in an ever more thoughtful way on what we can do to make more progress. I do believe there is an opportunity for all of us a decade from now to look back at the decade that was and say, now that is a decade that made a difference. That's what I believe our goal should be. Thank you.
Thank you. You can see why I was so excited to have Brad here. Brad, do you mind taking
some
questions?
Sure, I'd be happy to answer
questions. I'm happy to, if you don't mind turning on your microphone when you ask the question, just both because we're trying to hear, but also I think they're trying to record this so that they might, but that students who weren't able to hear and others might have a chance to take a look at it. So please do that, and also he asked me to tell you, please turn it off when you're done, so in case you're chewing gum or something like that. So the floor is open. Okay. Yeah, Professor Regan.
Yeah. Oh. Okay, I want to talk or ask you about the sort of professional development programs you have within the company, and in particular whether there are things that the company makes a special point of trying to ensure that women and minorities have access to. I'm thinking in law firms, for instance, there are, in the better law firms, there are efforts to ensure that women and minorities get sort of exposure to business development, client contact, mentoring relationships, that sort of thing. Are there analogs within the corporate legal department as well?
There absolutely are, and a few thoughts on that. Number one, I actually think our job is a little bit easier because we don't hire right out of law school. You know, we typically start hiring when people are perhaps 5 or 6 years out of law school, and sometimes much, much later. First, we have found that mentoring is absolutely critical. And indeed, one of the things that we have adopted is something that was first built in the finance part of the company, and that's to focus on mentoring not just from the standpoint of one-on-one mentoring relationships, but what are called mentoring rings. And so basically what those are typically a group of 8 to 10 individuals who create a mentoring ring. We typically have a large number of those folks be diverse, but not all of them. They're open to everybody. And then we have individuals, you know, work with those groups and come speak with and, you know, give advice to those groups. And one of the nice things about it is that the mentoring rings get to take charge of their own destiny to a significant degree, and I think this works for groups in a way that doesn't always work in the same way for individuals. They get to decide what do they really want to learn more about, and who do they want to have come speak and meet with them. So we've found the mentoring rings to be quite an interesting development that I take no credit for other than the fact that we copied it from the folks in finance who really pioneered it. The second thing that we've done that I think is interesting from a mentoring perspective is we've created a mentoring role with some individuals in law firms, specifically one of the larger Seattle firms called Davis Wright and Tremaine. Has a very active diversity program, and what we did is we, because they're one of the firms that does a good deal of work with us, we've assigned some of our lawyers to be mentors to some of their lawyers, diverse lawyers. You know, these are typically lawyers who are just sort of 1, 2, or 3 years out of law school. And I think we and they have found that to be a very helpful approach overall. So those are probably two of the more distinctive and perhaps innovative things that we've done. You know, we certainly have a variety of different development programs that start with orientation and then focus on different development areas. And I do think that it's just important to have good development programs and work overall. Because if you've got a good framework overall, then you can ensure that diverse people get to take advantage of it. And you can figure out that it's designed in a way that meets their needs. That's a far cry from, say, just not having an infrastructure to begin with. And so a lot of what we do is just focus on the infrastructure overall. We have an academy program with courses, have a course catalog. People can engage in that kind of training. We really focus on moving people around over the course of their careers. I happen to believe that in some ways the single best form of development is simply for people to do different jobs over time. And so one really needs to give some a forethought to, what is this person's skill set and what is a job that will enable him or her to, learn new things, but you also really want to have a good likelihood of success. So we really track mobility within the department, and we have defined goals for moving people around between groups in the department, and interestingly, one of the things that we found, which I think is just typical of the economy as a whole, is as the recession became greater, everybody became much more risk averse. They didn't want to try something new because they were afraid of the risk of failure. And so in recognition of that, we've launched a new effort inside our department in a very deliberative way to sort of, as we've said, restart that market to encourage people to move around and move into different jobs.
Yes, over here.
I just wanted to ask about how Microsoft has benefited from creating a more diverse environment and from partnering with others who have diverse environments.
Well, one of the things we say, and we absolutely believe it to be true, is that for us, diversity is a business necessity, and it's certainly a business necessity when it comes to our department, the Department of Legal and Corporate Affairs. Yeah, we do have about 1,000 people in the department. Of that, 1,465 are lawyers. 335 of those lawyers are in the United States. And all we got to do is look around at the people we interact with. We have an incredibly diverse employee population, especially when it comes to nationality. Microsoft has about 45,000 employees in the United States out of roughly 90,000. One-third of our employees in the United States actually come from outside the United States. They have over 145 different passports. So every day, our lawyers need to work with people that are as diverse as the planet, and we want them to be able to connect and understand those individuals effectively. When I think of what we need to do in terms of advocating on the company's behalf, well, you don't have to know very much these days to know, for example, that the president's an African American and the attorney general's an African American, and we've had European commissioners who are women, and we just have a very diverse group of people who are regulating the economy, who are sitting on the bench, who are making decisions that are going to impact our future. And I want us to be represented by a group of people that is as diverse as the people who are going to make decisions about us. So we actually feel that in some very concrete ways, some of the challenges, some of the legal challenges and some of the real roadblocks we hit, say, a decade ago, were roadblocks that we hit in part because we did not understand the way other people were perceiving us. We just understood the way we perceived us. And when we looked in the mirror, we liked what we saw. But when other people looked at us, they weren't always equally enthusiastic. And to me, sort of a life lesson from that is you really need to be able to understand what other people see when they talk to you, and you need to understand what problem they're trying to solve. And putting together more diverse teams of lawyers is part of how we address that, and I absolutely think it has served us very well as we've gone out, and one of the things we had to do over the last decade was mend some fences, and it was a lot easier to be better fence menders with a more diverse team of people.
Sure. Yes, right here.
So being a lawyer is rarely a 9-to-5 job. To climb the corporate ladder, you have to put in long days, and especially for women, a lot of women have chosen to take less demanding jobs and stay with their families. So has Microsoft thought of this issue, how to combine the family life with the progress in the corporate world?
We've certainly tried to take important steps to do that inside our department and inside the company. And so we've worked to create a variety of more flexible working arrangements. And that's quite varied. You know, at a almost mundane but important level, it is just flexible hours, so people can decide when they need to get to work and when they need to leave. And you know, the beauty of our technology, and sometimes not so beautiful part of it, is you can work from anywhere. And you know, we do have people who absolutely take advantage of that. You know, you people are working, and they may be, you know, at home. They may drive in later, or they may leave earlier, or they, you know, may take time out in the middle of the day to go take care of a doctor's appointment, or you know, go to a soccer match, or whatever. So flex time is one important thing. A second thing that we've tried to do is advance part-time arrangements to a greater degree. So we've enabled people to work on a part-time basis. We have found that certain jobs can be shared, so we have some job share arrangements where we have two individuals who actually share the same job, and you know, one person might work 3 days a week and the other person might work 2 days a week. Those are other steps that I think we've found to be important. You know, we have found that it's important and helpful to enable people to accelerate their career path at some points in their life and slow down their trajectory at other times of their life. So we've had women, for example, who have had enormous potential, who then have said, you know, I need to have some children over the next few years, and I really want to have a position that's going to be less demanding. And it'll slow down my trajectory, but that's the balance I want to strike. And they've done that. And in some important cases, they then sort of 10 years later said, okay, I'm ready for a different job now, one that will be more demanding. And we've made that possible for them to do. I actually think that one of the great reservoirs of talent in the legal profession in the country is women who've decided they no longer want to work at a law firm, and in some cases not even at a company. What they really just want to do is find a way to work from home. So one of the things we've done outside the confines of the department itself is created what we call the virtual firm. And the virtual firm is basically a network of solo practitioners who almost always work out of their home on a part-time basis. And then we provide what would otherwise be sort of the law firm infrastructure to support them. And you know, sometimes these individuals, especially women, will say, you know, in these months of the year, I'd like to work, you know, 80 hours a month, but I really can't work more than 10 hours a month in June and July and August when my kids are out of school. So we have made that possible, and we've reaped enormous benefits, I have to say, from just tapping into the talent and professionalism and experience of people who otherwise might have concluded that they needed to leave the law entirely. I will say, I think your question raises one of the questions that I believe is of fundamental importance that we don't really have an answer for as a profession. Certainly, I don't feel that I know the answer, and that is, are law firms going to have to rethink, you know, some of the fundamentals of their, you know, associate tracks, of their, of the whole, you know, partner model. You know, if you can get to only 19% of your partners being women with the model as it exists today, how much higher can you get through certain kinds of strategies, or do you actually have to step back and be prepared to change the model more generally if we're ever going to get to the kind of country where women among law firm leaders are comparable to, you know, women in the society as a whole, or even just the composition of women in law school classes? I think that's a thought-provoking question that actually deserves more attention across the profession than it probably has received to date.
Terry?
So this is extremely interesting presentation. I had no idea, to be honest, that Microsoft was doing these things. Here, one of the things that puzzles me about your account is I've long thought that there are two basic strategies in this area. One is, building off this last question, to identify and alleviate substantive or psychological impediments to the achievement of equality in the workplace, and then let the chips fall where they may. So you requires a lot of effort to identify these. They may involve opportunities for flexible timing, might involve childcare arrangements, may involve deliberately randomizing assignments that have mentoring capacities to them to overcome our natural tendencies to affiliate with people we find comfortable. Mm-hmm. May involve intervening strategically to place people in especially prominent leadership roles to alter expectations of who's capable of leading and so forth. The general strategy would be to repeat, identify and overcome specific impediments to equality, and then just let things fall where they may. You haven't done that, and in fact, you led with something that you acknowledge can sometimes be described as quota. Approaches in which you identify numerical targets and make deliberate efforts to reach them. So this is commendable on many levels, but also troublesome on other levels. So I suppose the least generous way of construing this would be it reflects lack of faith that it's sufficient to eliminate the preconditions for inequality, that alone will not get us where we want to go. And the more Procrustean, here are goals, we're going to achieve these numbers somehow or other, is essential, which is a discouraging image about the current status of race, gender, relations in the workplace?
That's a great question, and I'd offer a few thoughts. I mean, first, I will say that we started ourselves in part with the sense that there was an institutional prerogative, namely, if we were going to be effective as lawyers, we needed to be as diverse as the clients we worked with and the people who were making decisions about us and the people we were otherwise interacting with. So, you know, this wasn't just isn't diversity good, but a decision that diversity was important in our ability to be effective in doing our jobs. That was sort of a first premise. A second premise is absolutely one that we do believe, which is it takes more than good intentions to be successful in life, that you're actually more effective, especially when you're working with many individuals in a large institution, if you have a clear vision, a clear goal, an ability to measure yourself, the ability to be strategic, hold yourself accountable, and the like. And this is true regardless of the issue. We went through a similar exercise about a decade ago when the company got very focused on customer satisfaction. We said, look, we want to have what every company should want to have. We should want to have very satisfied customers. And so we measured the satisfaction of our customers, and we said, here's where we are. Everybody, this is important. Everybody said, yeah, it is. Let's go forth and do good, and you know, let's get these numbers higher. And the first 2 to 3 years, the numbers didn't get a bit better. In fact, they got worse. I think they got worse because everybody got so focused on the fact that our customer satisfaction was not what we wanted it to be, including our customers, that when they, in effect, were surveyed, they talked about how they were unhappy rather than happy. And then we got more strategic. You know, and we really said, okay, what we've got to do is really ask ourselves, what are the strategies that are going to drive the outcomes that we want? How are we going to organize and invest in those strategies? And by the way, how are we going to hold ourselves accountable by making part of the bonus payable on the basis of customer satisfaction? And we saw our customer satisfaction improve each and every one of the next 5 or 6 years in a significant way. And so I actually think that there are some lessons that are readily applicable to, you know, any area of, call it, organized life, and certainly any organized life in something like a business or a law firm. And so that is really what motivated us here. I do think there's a third element that your question alludes to that I didn't talk about, but it's very, very important. Yeah, the goal is to have a legal profession that is diverse and inclusive. And I've been talking about diversity. I actually have not been talking about inclusion. You know, certainly one of our goals is to have a department that not only has a diversity of backgrounds, but a culture that really utilizes those diverse backgrounds. And that's a both very important and a very difficult thing to have to create, because what you have to start to learn about is the different ways in which different people may want to express their opinions. Certainly when I think about the nationalities of the world, there are some nationalities where, in general, people are more comfortable being more assertive and stating their views. The United States is actually an example of such a society. There are other societies where people are not as comfortable being as forceful. They may hold back a little bit more unless you create the right kind of atmosphere and you train people when they're running meetings to be good facilitators and to bring out those views. But you know, I think myself that one would need to be very idealistic to think that just putting a group of diverse people in the same room will necessarily bring out the best of what each individual has to offer. You really actually need to be thoughtful about how to go about doing that. The last thing that we've done is something that we've done in a couple of other areas. We've certainly done it in the area of pro bono work and a lot of other areas, and that is to sort of tell ourselves that we want to be systemic in our approach. In other words, we're not just looking at the few things we do and asking ourselves, how can we do them, each of them 5% better? But how can we be much more systemic in more radical improvement over time? And you know, one of the things we really encourage people to do is to be bold, to start small, but to think big. You know, when we first started on this diversity work, if this was about 8 or 9 years ago, and a couple of us sat down and we said, you know, it's going to take us 5 years just to be at a point where we think that we're good. So our first goal is to get good. And each and every year, we pushed ourselves harder to build on the progress of the prior year and get better until we reached the point where we said, you know, we think we're actually good enough now to at least talk publicly about what we're doing. For the first 5 years, we wouldn't talk publicly at all. We didn't think, frankly, we were good enough to even start to share our ideas externally. And as we've taken further steps, I do think that it actually is quite important, and I think this is true in almost anything that one does, you know, to keep raising the bar on yourself and to keep creating a bolder vision of what you'd like to contribute to in terms of a more systemic outcome or some bigger change. And as we tell people, everybody starts work, they get a job description. I always like to say, your job description tells you where your job begins. You get to decide where it ends. And the people who do really well are those that over time, you know, define, you know, bigger opportunities for themselves to create bigger jobs and contribute in bigger ways. And we've tried to apply that to diversity as well.
Let me just ask you one more question, and I'm very mindful that we don't want to keep you too long, but Brett, this has just been amazingly interesting and helpful. But I want to pick up on something that you said partly in response to the question about women and whether or not there was going to have to be some fundamental rethinking of the law firm model. This is very much on the minds of many people today, and it's something that I spend a lot of time thinking about. I guess I'm curious how thinking about diversity has affected the way in which you do things in general in your legal department, in your relationship with law firms or internally. That is, we often think in the opposite direction, right? But what have you learned from working so intensively with diversity that actually has an effect on the way in which Microsoft does its business generally in this area?
Well, I think more than anything else, it's probably sparked a sense of creativity and an appreciation for the breadth of ways that one can successfully, you know, get something done, that one can really accomplish a goal. You know, it really goes back to the fact that if you bring people from different perspectives together, you're going to get a lot smarter. You're going to come up with new and better ideas about how to go do something. And, you know, so much of what we've had to do is navigate a global legal and regulatory thicket. And so we spend so much time, you know, really sitting down and negotiating with government officials or regulators or customers or competitors or somebody else in just about every part of the world. And, you know, you just really come to appreciate that you need a really diverse set of ideas. And a more diverse set of ideas is actually likelier to come from a more diverse set of people. But I also think you realize over time that sometimes some of the best ideas have two characteristics to them. One is that they come from people who aren't not necessarily the first out of the gate to put their idea on the table. You know, so you really have to create the kind of environment that encourages people to contribute those ideas. And second, as I say constantly, some of the best ideas in the world, maybe most of the best ideas in the world, start out as half-baked ideas. And I actually think, unfortunately, lawyers oftentimes can almost act on instinct to feel their role is to kill half-baked ideas. And yet, if some of the best ideas in the world start as half-baked ideas, what I say is then the role of people needs to be to take the half-baked ideas and figure out how to finish baking them. And that requires the kind of environment or culture where people can brainstorm freely and then you let ideas ruminate and then you really figure out how to take those ideas that seem interesting and figure out how to make them better rather than watch them die before the first meeting comes to an end.
Well, I don't think there have been many half-baked ideas here, but I think you've given us all a lot to think about, to bake on, and to stick to our knitting. So thank you very much, Brad. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you.